Thank you, Lee.
Thank you, Bruce. Good morning. I know we're a little bit behind time. I'll see if I can make some up. I told Bruce on Sunday morning I methodically cut this down from 95 slides to about 50, so we'll see how I do. Want to thank a lot of folks working on this. I'll be showing a lot of studies, a lot of names, and there are just way too many of them to actually recognize. Hit the right button. I'm going to talk about our history working particularly with VDOT. VDOT is the major disturber of wetlands in our state in general and drove this research program largely. Really started in the mid to 1990s, and I want to address three commonly held fallacies that a lot of the regulators and the consultants, both we have dealt with, have held. The first one is if you just make it wet enough, the soils don't matter. And that is, unfortunately, today is still an opinion among many people designing wetlands. The second one is that 5% is a magic organic matter level, and all you got to do is get, you know, that back in soil, and that you can do it in a one-time application and everything works great. And the third one is that you can't build a successful accreted wetland site in a coarse textured substrate. And then I'll talk about the development of our guidance over time. So let's start here. It's 1991. Your VDOT regulation protecting wetlands is now in force, and you're building created wetlands. This is the largest one they built in the early 90s. This is called Fort Lee. And this was an interesting one. This picture was taken in 98. So at this point in time, it's 7 years old. That is supposed to be entirely forested wetland. It had been planted for 7 years. It was real wet on this side. Of 40 acres, they were only getting from the agency's recognition of maybe 5 acres as being credit. I made the mistake of standing up at a meeting one time talking about interpreting soil morphology and wetness regimes, and they said, okay, Daniels, we want you to go out there and look at this site and see why it's failing. Had a student named Angie Whitehead. She worked with me on a number of sites. This is a picture of the soil pit. Basically, what they were doing in those days is going down, cutting into the underlying argillic horizon, bringing back typically upland topsoil, replacing it, assuming they would get elevations about right, and that was basically, at that point in time, the state of the art. This area here, which that picture was taken, was actually about here, is dominated by tall fescue, broom sedge, and red cedar. I mean, obviously not what is necessary. We go 200 feet away, though, to almost the same elevation into the adjacent forest. This is what the native soil looked like, obviously, at another time of the year. This is the hydro period of those two soil pits. All right, they are both poorly drained. If you look solely at hydro period alone, they both stay wet at or near the surface for almost 6 weeks into the, and they have a very similar hydro period. But you've got, again, a seven-year-old soil with that sort of a wetness regime, and it ain't doing nothing, right? There's no redox features. Well, why? One is it's low in carbon, which would be expected. It was up into the topsoil. Perhaps more importantly, was bulk density. And we saw this time and time again, particularly in the 1990s, is these sites were just tight as drums. They were built by engineers, put in by grading contractors, and packed to death. All right. So obviously an issue with route limiting bulk. And we have data sets like this. This is just for this site, and this is actually an average of about the 14 locations at that site. So Mark Stolt was working with us at that point in time as a postdoc. He said, well, Lee, maybe it's just the combination of low organic matter. We don't have, you know, palatable organic matter in there and this bulk density thing. Let me do a control study of what would happen if we add organic matter. Mark did something called the buried bag study, which was fairly innovative. He took upland soil, loaded it with fresh red maple leaves that he had ground up, packed it back in these nylon bags, and that's actually woman's pantyhose is what that is, and buried it back in at varying depths in the wetland. And then he went back after 2 years and dug up all these clods. We drove lab technicians nuts from separating out the nylon outer bag and then washing out roots. And so this is what happened in terms of root to proliferation into a buried nylon bag that had organic matter added to it. This is a without. So it's pretty clear the roots, and there was a definite rooting response to go to the organic matter over time. And then he did a lot of analysis and found that when he added amended organic matter, it's breaking down, it's driving redox, you're losing iron, the iron's migrating out of those bags, and I'm seeing redox features. So again, this was the first strong evidence we had, is even moderate amounts of organic matter additions could drive redox and also interact with rooting. So then we went to the Charles City mitigation wetland. This is the one of the sites that Kurt talked about. This was built in 1997. And the question was what's an optimal organic matter loading rate? Well, by that point in time, our regulators had somehow gotten the concept that 5% organic matter was a magic level. We couldn't figure out why. If you take compost that's only 40 to 60% organic and 50% solids and try to add it to a soil to get to 5% organic matter and assume that maybe a third to 40% of it is going to decompose over time, as Kurt was saying, you have to put hundreds and hundreds of tons per acre down. I mean, it's incredibly high rate. So we put out these loading rate experiments. Where did the 5% come from? It comes from Brady. I finally found out. They said, yeah, Brady says 5% organic matter is a magic level, and literally that's what I had the Corps and our state say, is yeah, it's based on Brady. What the fallacy is, that's by volume. That's not by weight. That's less than 2% by weight. So anyway, we go on. This is what the Charles City site looked like when it was built, cut down into the subsoil. This is what the subsoil looked like, highly compacted. Why did they do this intentionally? They still do this today to generate an epiaquic system because their water budgets are driven by surface water. And to get a permit approved, unless you got a lot of groundwater data, you drive it as an epiaquic perching system. So we commonly have these really tight layers in them. This is the loading rate experiment that was talked about last time, but this is why these rates were so high. We're not advocating rates like this, but we needed a range of rates to show what that response was. We did rough up the surface. We added organic matter at the varying rates. This was a high quality wood waste compost, about 50% solids. 25 dry tons or 56 tons per hectare, you can cut that in easily. You still see it, and that's a fairly significant amendment. You get to those higher rates, I don't care what you cut on it with a disc and how many times you hit it with a rototiller, you don't get it in the ground. I mean, it just doesn't go in. It sits up there like a pillow. This is Kara Bergschneider, worked on it for her thesis. She went out there and sampled it. And so after 2 years, this is the effect of organic amendment at a low rate after 2 years. We saw this consistently. There's a significant effect within 2 years of adding organic matter. You get lower chroma. You get more prominent redox concentrations. You actually take iron masses and you move them away. Now, that's at the 56 rate. This is the 112 rate. Look at all those iron concentrations. Now, the higher rates, though, it's just a sitting up on top. You're really not doing any good at those higher rates. You're just building a well-aerated pillow out there, essentially. As Kurt talked about, she also looked at bulk density. What about tree growth? Well, the primary successional species that Jim talked about, and Jim Perry worked on this with us, things like river birch do well. You see a response in both experiments to increasing loading rates. However, the later stage oaks, the pin oak, at least at this point in time, had not responded. A lot of other folks have worked on it, including Dave Bailey at VIMS. He found little effect of the organic matter loading on herbaceous vegetation, but it did result in increased volume of the trees. And like I said, you build it and they will come. We've been very fortunate that we've had a number of our students and several from Duke and VIMS work on this. And Emily Ott, who's sitting back here now is working on this site as her PhD work, and this is what these trees look like now after about 13 years. And yeah, there's still a residual effect of an organic matter loading we did a long time ago, and you can still see it here. And like Kurt just said, it's still losing a lot of CO2 in the summer when it gets warm. Powerful quote. This is one of the first paired papers ever published looking at created wetlands versus natural ones. Came out of Penn State. And this is a quote that was in the conclusions of it. And this is a quote that our regulators misused for years. They said, no, if it's a coarse loamy substrate, you can't build a wetland out of it, because by definition, a coarse textured soil is going to be well-drained and well-aerated. And that led us to work on this site. This is the Wayanak wetland. Richmond is in the background. Again, it's a middle coastal plain site. This is all sandy dredge spoil that the Corps of Engineers dumped up on top of a mud flat marsh in the 1950s and 60s. This is what it looked like. It was a great stand of weeping love grass and basically a desert. The owner cut it down as part of a mitigation effort with VDOT. Note the color here. This is a brown sand. It had quite a bit of iron on it, even at the cut elevation. This is a tidal freshwater forested wetland site. All right. This elevation is about 1 foot above mean high tide. We ran a number of treatments there. We have a fertilized check. We have a couple of compost rates. These are wet loading rates. We have topsoil with compost, and then topsoil only. Again, this isn't a pile of sand. This is medium sand. Here's my buddy Rich Whitaker, hydrologist, helping us put in pits and mounds. We also installed intentionally pits and mounds and then retreated them as need be. This is what it looks like at high tide. High tide comes up. You see the pits are full of water, and here is the mounds. Here's compost and topsoil. And so this is in 2004. This is a little later. We planted cypress trees. One cypress tree on every mound, one cypress tree in every pit, and then multiple cypress trees out on the flats. Mike Nestor was a master student working on it. This is after 3 years. So this is in topsoil. The fine texture topsoil met F3 in 3 years, no problem. That went in between 10YR and 4-4 and 10YR 5-4 uniform. There were no redox features whatsoever in the topsoil added. You'll also note a strong redox band right at the contact between the topsoil and the sand. This is just a shot of what the original soil looked like. This is a photo from 2009. Again, the whole thing is going gray, losing the chrome with time. This is a picture taken a few weeks back. These are the sandy soils we talked about. Now, this is all naturally accumulating organic matter over time. We've had a significant decrease in the chroma, but you often don't get enough redox concentrations high enough that it'll actually meet sandy redox. But it's clearly a wet soil. Finally, we had a postdoc come in and look at the cypress trees. This is a cypress tree in a pit. This is a cypress tree on a mound. The cypress trees in pits are consistently taller and bigger than the ones on mounds. This is the paper that recently came out on that. If you're ever interested in debunking a two-way ANOVA, talk to me. To do this, you've got to do it based on paired delta values. If you ever do a study like this, you've got to do the deltas of the pits minus the mounds. So that led us then to the recommendations. This is what is policy in Virginia. It's not always enforced, but you get your subsoil right, avoid compaction. It's going to be compacted. You should rip or chisel plow the subsoil. We've established bulk density targets for it. If you can save your natural hydric soil, save it and put it back, but a lot of times you can't. If there's a mitigation ratio of 2-1, you're only going to have 50% of the hydric soil to go back, and it's typically not saved. A lot of it is sold. If not, add organic matter amendments. Again, we recommend anywhere between 75 and 100 tons tons per hectare, but there's no sense in shooting from magic 5%. There's no validity. But adding the organic matter drives it the right direction, makes it go towards redoxymorphic features, and that's what you want. The topsoil will need to be ripped again. Whenever possible, put in hammocks and pits and mounds. It's easy to do. You just take a damp backhoe and drive across the site and put pits in. It's not hard. And if there is any available woody materials, return it to the site. And finally, avoid sulfitic materials. This was mentioned earlier, about 25% of the sites that VDOT has built in the coastal plain of Virginia have hit sulfides at depth. And when you get that, you get pH 2.5. So this was actually then since 2004, and that's 2015, and most of the experiments I talked about weren't put in until the 2000s. Well, why have these been in place so long? They've been in place because of this site. This is called New Dunn. New Dunn was the litigation case between Swank and Rapanos that went to the Supreme Court that said that if a wetland is physically connected by even a ditch or a roadway to waters of the USA, it's still jurisdictional. We were told by a federal judge that Rich Whitaker and I, and somehow Jim Perry over here, weaseled out of that litigation, I don't know how, to come up with a system, and that's where the bulk density and organic amendments were done at that site. So we've had a lot of support, a lot of folks working with this, particularly Jim and Rich Whitaker, and we do occasionally work on field sites at the same time. So.
One question for Lee.
Mike.
This is the first talk I've seen where you've mentioned bulk density being too high and being root restricted in mineral soil.
Absolutely.
All right, so you get different values, at least based on agricultural studies, for sands than you do for clays.
Right.
Have you ever seen a condition where organic soil material has become so compact roots can't get into it?
Personally, no, but... But I can tell you, there's probably 80% of the wetland creation in Virginia is done with this perching seal. And typically, you're hitting a root-limiting bulk density at less than a foot down.
In mineral soil.
In mineral soils. And it is leading to a failure of the planted trees, and it's leading to wetland conversion. We're not putting back type for type. We're putting back more shrub scrub things rather than in the forced
soil,
wetland.
Mineral soil.
I've never seen it in a organic soil. No.
Okay, so bulk densities are below 1, whether they're 0.5, 0.6, 0.8, it doesn't make any difference from a root competing standpoint. Probably not even less than 1.2.
I agree. Okay. Yeah.
All right, we need to move on.